Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of November the 4th, 2019. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and we're going to talk about what happened this week in taxes. Now, I'm a little bit late recording this week because I was on the road for most of the week. I started out in Albuquerque, spent a day in Seattle at the Washington's tax conference, and then went on to Boise, Idaho. So I got things written up here a little bit late this week, so it's taking a little bit of time to get things together. So we're a little bit behind this week on our standard scheduling. But we're going to go over still some things that happened during the week. We're going to start with a discussion of a case in Wisconsin where the state was trying to take a look and expand their view of what represents market-based sourcing to cause Microsoft to pay tax on copies of Windows that OEMs were selling into the state of Wisconsin on a computer, selling it that were just part of computers. We're also going to then go on next and look at a case where a taxpayer attempted to get credit for both 121 and 1031 to be able to exclude the gain on the sale of a residence and to be able to treat that as a 1031 tax-free exchange. And we'll talk about how that works and why the taxpayer in this case, the IRS agreed, was capable to do so. And finally, I'm going to take a look at the new instructions for the Form K-1 and, you know, kind of work that out, how the K-1s work and what we're doing here, the new K-1s for Form 1065 and new Form 1065. I want to remind you that we do have now, coming up, some additional days with CalCPA on the State Society rebroadcast. If your state participates in the CalCPA programs, I do have a program coming up on Section 199 Cap A. That's 199 Cap A, Qualified Business Income Deduction Explained, planning for that Qualified Business Income Deduction. It'll come on November the 26th. These begin at both 6 and 8 a.m. It should be Pacific Standard Time, not daylight time. I've got to really correct this slide. I can tell when I repeat it. It is going to be standard time because you all moved your clocks again. So it'll be on either time starting. Your state society probably picks one that's more relevant for your area where you are. And, you know, we'll be doing that. We'll be talking about 19 Cap A, how it works, how the new rental rules work, and some of the other key topics. And I'll be recording that session here coming up in a little over a week in Phoenix, and then it'll be broadcast on the 26th. So if you want to, check your state society. A number of state societies participate in CalCPA's programs. They'll have this listed on their website or a way you can sign up on their website for this course. Consider doing it. It's an 8-hour course. It is live CPE, so you get live credit. So consider checking in for that. Let's start with our first case of the week. This is the case of the Wisconsin Department of Revenue versus Microsoft Corporation. This is a case that went to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, District 4. It's appeal number 2018 AP2024. It was issued on Halloween, October the 31st. This case involves a situation probably we're all used to. You actually can, if you want to build your own PC, you can go out and buy a boxed retail copy of Windows and install that on a PC. I've done that a couple of times when I've acquired a PC, when I built one up, when we were installing on Macs and we're using VMware. We do that sort of thing. I've also done it sometimes when, you know, I've just been rebuilding an old PC and, you know, had an old PC. It was there. I took it over, sans hard drive from where it came from before, and I get put a new hard drive in. I reinstall Windows, and maybe it turns out there's no license attached on the machine. So I just go ahead and get a retail copy, and you do it that way. So I've done that, but 99 times out of 100, we're going to find out that CPAs and everybody else in business is probably getting their computers with Windows pre-installed from the vendor. So how that works is Microsoft licenses Windows to the OEM. The OEM will then install Windows on the computer when it's built, and they will pay Microsoft a fee at that point for a license. That license grants the OEM the right to sublicense Windows, you know, on that machine, you know, the single copy. When somebody buys the machine, then, of course, they enter into a sublicense with the vendor, be it Dell, Lenovo, HP, Asus, Acer, whoever it might be, and they then are able to use Windows, right? Now, the state of Wisconsin was arguing that that sublicense really should be considered to be directly from Microsoft to the end user. And that's important because, in their view, that means that this license would create Wisconsin source income and that Microsoft would owe tax to the state of Wisconsin income taxes for this license income, their net income from that licensing. It would go into the apportionment formula. Now, Microsoft disagreed, and at the initial appeals level, when they initially took the case up to their first level, you have to challenge them administratively, the State Department of Revenue lost on that one. So the Department of Revenue then took it to an appeals court in Wisconsin. You know, the court said, you know, originally said no. This court also disagreed. Why? Well, the issue was, as we note, Microsoft licenses the software to the actual OEM. Their contract is with Dell, Lenovo, HP, whatever the vendor is. That's who their contract's with. That contract says that once they install that software on a PC, regardless of whether anybody ever buys it, they owe the license fee at that point. So Dell, Lenovo, HP pays Microsoft every time they install Windows on a machine. If that machine is ultimately sold, they have the right to essentially sublicense that one copy on that one machine to their customer. And so, as you might guess, not too many PCs have their Windows installed in the state of Wisconsin. For the most part, it kind of happens the way last time I ordered machines from Lenovo, ordered some ThinkPads. I ordered the ThinkPads. We watched them being assembled. We watched them being, you know, on the system when they were going to be shipped. They were actually assembled and boxed up, and Windows was installed while the machines were in China. Definitely was not installed in Arizona, where we're at. So essentially, you know, they're saying, hey, you know, that's really where the income transfer takes place. It's not, you know, the fact that Lenovo sent it to the U.S. and then sold it in Wisconsin isn't relevant. That PC could have gone anywhere, and that PC, you know, might not have been sold at all. Lenovo could have used it internally. It still would have worked the same way. The state of Wisconsin said no. Now, they do admit that under the normal circumstances, under Wisconsin law, under the standard Wisconsin apportionment rules, what counts in this case is essentially where the income, right, is going to be actually earned from activity in the state. But, they said, well, there's a special rule for gross receipts from computer software. And that says receipts of computer software counts as Wisconsin income where the licensee uses the software at a location in Wisconsin. Now, if you're a CPA firm in Milwaukee and you bought, like we did, you know, these Lenovo ThinkPads, that was going to be used clearly in a location in Wisconsin, just like the ThinkPads we bought are being used at a location in Arizona. But the court said there's a problem here, and it's a statutory problem. The Wisconsin statute said the licensee, where the licensee uses the software. The statute had no reference to sublicensee. Now, this theory about why it's not going to be taxable is probably good news, bad news for us. Why? Because what the decision comes down to was not so much that the state of Wisconsin couldn't have made it based on where the sublicensee was, just more the statute didn't say that. And since it didn't say that, we didn't have to worry about looking through to ultimate consumer. This concept of looking through to the ultimate consumer, where you have a sale of a product that is like an intangible or a service, is a bit problematical in many cases. Why? Well, consider like the case where I record a session, like I was saying, that sessions I'm going to be recording here in Phoenix at the Arizona Society's offices during an Arizona Society presentation that will eventually be recorded and then transferred to Cal CPA, who will then turn around and, you know, basically market it, and it'll go be sold through various other state societies, and people in some other state will be using it. So conceivably, here's how that transaction works. You know, I record a session. I have contracted, or my firm has contracted with Kaplan to provide that service. Kaplan contracts with the Arizona Society of CPAs. The Arizona Society of CPAs then turns around and licenses the right to use that audio and video to Cal CPA. And again, we've all agreed they could do that. Then Cal CPA turns around, and then they market it. Of course, they sell it to their members, but they also sell it to members of a bunch of other state societies. So conceivably, that particular session I'm going to be giving in Phoenix here sometime next week, we can turn that around and say, well, ultimately, does that represent income based on where the ultimate consumer is. So let's say, for instance, that you are located in Milwaukee. So do I have to take some portion of what I would be paid for doing the program in Phoenix next week? And let's say if you take that on a rebroadcast, let's say that rebroadcast is in January, do I have to then somehow include part of that income into my income for this year? And that's also one of the complications. Note, in that theory, if we do the full look through to the customer, well, there's going to be a customer in January of next year that hasn't even done anything with it yet. But in theory, I would need to look through today in 2019 to see where that customer will be. The same thing would happen to Microsoft. You know, Lenovo may have installed it on a ThinkPad here in October of 2019, but for whatever reason, that ThinkPad may never get sold to an actual customer until sometime in 2020. And if let's say Microsoft's a calendar year taxpayer, then again, there's a problem. At the date when they have to file the return, they don't know where that's going to be licensed. Well, you know, it's a complicating factor, but unfortunately, it's not one. The court didn't knock it off for that factor. They knocked it off just because the statute didn't refer to it. The states are getting very creative at going after trying to get it out of state income, people who are not paying taxes, into the state. They'll argue that that's for fairness. But the reality is the states are very, I'm sure the legislatures are very clear, and governor's offices are, who run the administrative functions, that those people don't pay tax in the state. And so it's much nicer to get your money from people that aren't paying tax in the state and aren't voting and can't vote you out of office. So getting it from that area makes sense. It lets you tell the voters about how you haven't raised taxes on them because you've gone and found somebody else to collect it from. So expect the states to get a lot more aggressive in this area because we've already seen that happening. Next is a private letterhealing request to the IRS, PLR 2019-44-006, from November the 1st of this year. And this looked at the case of a taxpayer who is trying to apply both the 121 exclusion on gain of principal residence. Remember, you have to have owned and used the home two of the 5 years immediately prior to the sale to qualify for the exclusion, and also use Section 1031. Which is a tax-free exchange of real estate that only applies if the property is used for investment or business purposes, not for personal purposes. And the question they were asking is, given their fact circumstance, do both 121 and 1031 apply to the sales? And there are a couple of reasons they were concerned about both questions, and we'll talk about them here. But it might be initially like, well, how could they both apply? 121 is clearly related to personal use of an asset. 1031 doesn't apply to personal assets. But as the IRS points out, it actually can happen that both come into play. In this case, we have a piece of property. The property was originally acquired by one of the taxpayers. And then when the couple were, you know, married sometime later, the couple, you know, the person that the owner of the house married moved into the house and it became their personal residence. They used it for a number of years, certainly at least 2 years, because there was no question here about them not qualifying based on that. And then they acquired a new residence. They did not ever immediately get rid of the old residence. They rather converted to a rental property. Now, this rental property was, for a portion of the period, basically sold to leased to a full-time renter. But there also were chunks of times at the beginning and the end of the period it was used in this way, where it was mainly being rented out on a part-time basis. So if you needed it, you know, basically short-term rentals. So for instance, it'd be like a vacation property, where, oh, I want to go on vacation for 2 weeks, so I'll rent your property for 2 weeks, and then we're out of here, and I got to go find another short-term tenant to fill it in because I don't have a long-term lease. Well, they continued to use it, so like I said, they had the short-term rentals, then they had a time period where they had long-term tenants, and then they went back to short-term rentals. And at the end of the period for rentals, what happened was they were renting it right up to the point which the house burned down. When the house burns down in a fire, they get insurance proceeds for the house. They decide not to rebuild the home, but rather just go ahead and get rid of the land in a 1031 exchange, or what they hope is a 1031 exchange. And the taxpayer now is going to ask three questions of the IRS. And what they want is they want three questions answered in this private letter ruling. First, they want to know, did the Section 121 exclusion on gain of a sale of principal residence apply in their fact pattern? Number two, Is it possible for both 121 and 1031 to apply to the same series of sales? And finally, they wanted to know was the property they disposed of held for investment purposes for 1031? And the IRS answered these generally in the way the taxpayer would prefer. What the IRS first tells us is that, yes, Section 121 works for a dual sale. They specifically talk about the under Regulation 1.121-1B3I, we have a sale of land separate from the residence. And that says, if you have the right fact pattern, we can do that. If the land was clearly used as part of the residence, even if it's eventually sold separately from the residence, remember, now normally we're thinking about there where maybe we have two lots, we have a vacant lot, and the lot our house is on, and we use the house, you know, we use the lot with the house on, we sell that off, and then maybe 2 months later, we sell the vacant lot next door. That's kind of what this was meant for, but they said it applies in this case too, even though obviously the house was quote-unquote sold by insurance proceeds, and then the land was then transferred, because at that point it was just land, to a party who didn't care there wasn't a house on it, in fact, probably wanted to build their own house on it, and was just as happy there was nothing there. So, you know, that worked out for them. And they ruled that, yes, this would work. How this works is that first sale, which in this case was the insurance proceeds, since we're not rebuilding, that gain is going to be taxable normally. But you would look at that. You could still use up to the $500,000 exclusion as it were married, and they did meet the 205 test. So they had used it and owned it and used it as a principal residence for two of the 5 years immediately before the date of sale. So they qualified for the exclusion. So we get our dual sale. We get this transaction. Then let's say if you used up $400,000 of your exclusion on that sale, when you then turn around and sell the land, you'll get an exclusion for up to $100,000. The IRS also notes that you can have both a 121 exclusion and a 1031 exchange deferral on the same transaction. That was ruled in Revenue Procedure 2005-14, told us this was possible. And in fact, what it tells us in that revenue procedure in Section 4.02 is that when this happens, you first apply 121. So in this case, we would use $100,000, I just said, of gain we hadn't used in selling the house. We'd apply that against any gain on the land sale. And then 1031 would apply to the other gain. If there is boot, the boot first is considered a trigger gain that would be excluded under 121. So if we had, let's say, $100,000 of boot, in our fact pattern, we'd still pay no tax because the 121 exclusion would wipe out the $100,000 of boot, and then any other gain would be wiped out by the 1031 exchange. And again, that they said that that's been out there for a while, 2005-14, 14 years ago, we told you this would work. Finally, they took a look at, in this fact pattern, did they actually have investment property? And there they primarily said that, well, the taxpayers are representing to us that, you know, when they moved out of it, they used it as a rental. We're going to basically accept the representation. Nothing's been represented. You know, if their representations are correct about the situation, then it would be investment property. Again, private letter ruling, the IRS is not going to rule in a factual situation ever. They're, you know, so they're going to say, as long as your representations are correct, one of your representations is it's rental property, then it could be a 1031 exchange. Interesting case, and again, remember, sometimes this means you can use things you might not think could be used together. This was an interesting application of using both Section 121 and Section 1031. The final thing I want to talk about this week is the IRS got around to issuing the draft instructions for the 2019 Form 1065 and Schedule K-1. They issued these on the 29th and 30th of October. The 1065 instructions came out on the 29th. The K-1 instructions came out on the 30th, right? So those instructions and those for the K-1s are out. And you may remember a couple weeks earlier, they had released the instructions for the 1120, and 1120S, I should say, 1120S K-1. And to a large extent, much of what we saw there gets duplicated here. They do tell us about what's new. And they tell us various things are new in the 1065. They talk about two new questions in Schedule B, one where it asks you if the number of foreign partners that transferred all or part of their interest and received a distribution subject to 864C8. That's also important for withholding purposes now, so there's a reason why they want that. and they want some additional disclosures for disguised sales on question 28. Schedule K, they tell us, remind us, they have split the, and on K1, guaranteed payments now go into two categories, those for services and those for capital. Finally, schedules lines 16, D, and K are reserved for future use because 951A categories are no longer reported on schedules K and K1. So they're gone now. On K1 itself, they remind us, because we did get our K1 instructions, right? We're going to have more details for 19 Cap A, plus a few other things. As we've talked about before, we saw on the K1, on item E on the K1, there's going to be a parenthetical to caution us using the tax ID number of a disregard entity. They don't want the ID number of the disregard entity, that's Sigma Member LLC. They want the taxpayer's ID, in essence, the Social Security number of the taxpayer who you're going to deem to be the owner of everything should be on there. If there is a disregard entity, we now do ask separately for the name and TIN of that entity. And again, the name you put in the address block is supposed to be the name of the person whose ID number is up there in the top block. They remind us of that. They are going to say a new checkbox has been added with liabilities shown in item K, include liabilities from lower tier partnerships. In item L, the partner's capital accounts must be reported on a tax basis method. There's no checkboxes for other methods because you can't do it that way anymore. A new item has been added for the partnership of unrecognized 704C gain or loss beginning end of the year. And as I said, that code F on box 11 will no longer be used. New code V has been added for box 13 for any negative income effects from 743B adjustments. Box 20, code Z through AD were previously used to report 19 Cap A information, has now been changed. Now only code Z is going to be used for that purpose. Box 20, we're going to have code AA for net income or loss of 704C adjustments on this return. Box 20, code AC is used for any deemed gain or loss. For one H5 collectibles from sale partnership interest. Box 20 code AD is used for deemed gain under section 1250 from sale of the interest. Box 20 new code AH is going to be net section 743B adjustments for partners with base adjustments. And then lines 21 and 22, the new lines have checkboxes indicate that their attachments to the Schedule K1 related to the partnership having more than one activity for section 465 at-risk purposes and more than one activity for 469 passive activity purposes, right? The draft schedule K1 pretty much repeats what they have on those boxes. The other big thing that happens is, if you remember, we got new statements A, B, and C for 1099S earlier, right? And we got a checklist. Those now are being duplicated on the K1s for the partnership. So you're going to have statement A for QBI pass-through and pass-through entity reporting. You're going to have the aggregations would have to go on schedule B of the K1 if we aggregate anything. And if the partnership is a patron for a specified agricultural and horticultural cooperative where we have 199 Cap AG issues in play, that information goes on Schedule C. The checklist that we have for what should be in QBI, that's also been included on the return. So we have the drafts for next year and those new schedules. As we suspected, it will be both for the Schedule K1 and, or I should say, both for the 1120S and for the 1065. There's not going to be anything unusual because of a partnership versus S-Corp in that realm. Well, again, we're in CPE season and serious CPE season right now. If you haven't already registered for your CPE for this fall and into the early winter, I know for the most part it'll be fall because officially winter doesn't start till, you know, into late December. And by then, a lot of you are pretty much, they're not taking CPE, then you're going to check out. Some of you will be in January, but most of it gets done here from October 15th to December 15th. We know that. Make sure you get your registration. Look what's coming up. We do have some coming up I want to remind you of that I'll be doing on the 7th and 8th of November. The Arizona Federal Tax Institute goes on. I will be giving the federal tax update to close it out on day two. That'll be the 8th. On November the 12th, we'll have that planning with qualified business income deduction. That's the one being recorded for Cal CPA, but it's being live here in Phoenix and broadcast that day live. So if you want to come down and, you know, take it, or you want to take it online that day, you know where to sign up, the Arizona Society offices. On the 13th in Phoenix, I will have 4 hours of new businesses advising clients on related tax issues and estate planning for the 99%. Those are each four-hour courses. On the 14th and 15th, I'll be in Tucson. On the 14th, it'll be our first run of current federal tax developments in Arizona. That'll be the Tucson version, talking about what's gone on this year. You know, we'll talk about all those things back and forth, talk about what we've seen during the year and what's coming in Tax Cut and Jobs Act developments, what's come in other case law, the new legislation, including the Taxpayer First Act. We'll take a look at all of that in Tucson. On the 15th, I'll do the 2 4-hour sessions I normally do, one of which is Arizona County Ethics, and the second one is Arizona Income Taxes Update and Review. I also have some dates coming up in New Jersey. On the 20th, in Iceland, New Jersey, we're going to be doing current federal tax developments in New Jersey. Or I should say, actually, it should be Advanced Tax Update. Get the right term. That's going to be the advanced version of the course. The key difference in advanced version is we assume you've had a few years of experience more. We assume we're talking to people that are involved in supervising. So we're going to have a much more, you know, kind of figuring that we can talk at a higher level in that day. So we don't have to worry about simplifying everything. And that allows us to look at a little more detail at some more complicated areas. We're also going to have on the 21st in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, it's scheduled for advising clients on related tax issues and accounting, auditing, and tax consideration for the cannabis industry. Those are, you have both of those courses you can sign up for as one. That's how you sign up for them there. So it'll be a single 8-hour day. We have two sets of what's effectively 4-hour discussions in the 8-hour day. Morning, dealing with advising clients and new businesses. Afternoon, dealing with advising and dealing with issues in the cannabis business. So if you're in the New Jersey Society, NJCPA, you can sign up at their website for these courses. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of November the 4th. You can find my updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com on the web. We'll post them there as things happen. This past week, I've got to get these updates up there. Now, actually, I finished recording because I got behind there and I haven't got them posted yet, but I'll get these updates posted there. And you can still download, if you're listening to this, the PDF with them in it. So we've got that going. If you have any questions or comments, send them to me, at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you want to follow me on Twitter, and I'll post updates there when things happen, you can go to @EdZollers. You can also follow discussions on the subreddit of /r/taxpros on reddit.com. I follow along as well on discussion groups for 4 state societies. I participate in Tax Talk for the California Society. That is currently on Yahoo Groups, groups.yahoo.com. But it is going to be moving here shortly to Groups.io once we have that happen. I will let you know here about how you get into it over there. Right now, it's in the middle of transitioning because Yahoo is clearly in the middle of getting rid of Groups. So they're going to be transitioning to a position that's a little more stable at Groups.io. So we'll let you know when I get started. I also, though, follow along on the Connect sites for the Arizona Society of CPAs, Minnesota Society of CPAs, and the New Jersey Society of CPAs. If you're a member of one of those societies, you can check in there, ask questions. If I see something I think I can help by responding to, I try to respond in those areas. So, you know, post there. And there's lots of other people checking out on those boards. So you can actually get a lot of good guidance there anyway and get a lot of discussions going on how tax matters work. Well, this week, I'm only on the road slightly. Like I said, I do the tax conference here in Phoenix on Friday. I am doing one in-firm session this week, so I'll be on the road for a little while. Actually going back up to Idaho again. So I'll be up there. Remember, if your firm's interested in having us do in-house sessions, it's a little bit late for this year, although there still are some days available. And here at Kaplan, we do both A&A, you know, accounting and auditing updates. We do tax updates or any courses that we offer. And you can check with your state society for setting that up for us. But, you know, it's a little closed for this year. I still could maybe jam days in, but it would be one of those where I would tell you the days I might be able to do it. And then you'd accept, unless you're willing to go into January when we have a little more chance that you could pick a day. But if you really want to have it in November, if I didn't have it in November, it gets really tough. If you want to have it in December, then, yeah, we're going to be squeezing you in there very tightly, assuming we can make the other travel work. So, although obviously Christmas Eve is fine if you want to have it that day, but I suspect nobody does. But, you know, days like that are open, the last week's open. Probably don't want those, but we do that work. So if you want interest in that work, contact your state society. They can help you set it up with us so we have it. Otherwise, we're going to see you next week, and hopefully I'll have more time to write things up then. And we'll talk about what's been happening in the area of current federal tax development.